Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin.
Well, you know that date, May 20th, 1775, on our state flag? You remember that?
Don't?
Well, then what you need to do is to read a new book. It's called The First American Declaration of Independence, The Disputed History of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775. And if you want to learn about it right now, we're fortunate to have the author of that book, Scott Seifer, who will, I hope, tell us a little. Scott, will you tell us a little bit about about the book?
I'll tell you as much as you want to know and probably more, D.G. Thanks for having me.
No, good. Well, you practice law with a fine firm of Moore & Van Allen in Charlotte. You're a lawyer. And you bring the investigative and advocacy skills to the book. But how in the world? I know Moore & Van Allen, and they work you hard there.
Yeah, that's right.
How did you find time to write the book?
Well, first I gave up golf. That freed up a lot of weekends. No, actually, the real answer is, so some young professionals, including myself, started a group 10 years ago in Charlotte called the May 20th Society. And the genesis of that was I was literally sitting around a bar with some friends, and a buddy of mine was telling me the story of how Mecklenburg County in North Carolina had declared independence from Great Britain before anybody else in the American colony, and how it had been a huge, North Carolina event, that it was a huge controversy, and that this tavernator named James Jack had ridden to Philadelphia to deliver what's called the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence to Congress, but the Congress said, thanks, but no thanks, this is premature, and sent him home. So I heard this whole story, and I thought, this is unbelievable. I've never heard of this in my life. I mean, I grew up in Charlotte. I went to Chapel Hill, both for undergrad and law school. And I'd probably been taught this story at some point in my, my education. But it was all new to me. So we started this group called the May 20th Society, really to bring the commemoration back. As you point out, the date May 20th, which is the date of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, May 20th, 1775, is on the state flag. It's actually on the great state seal of North Carolina. It used to be a county and city holiday in Charlotte, so it was a big deal. And in the last 30 years, it just disappeared, as if it never happened. So when we started this group, for whatever reason, we get inquiries from the press or from people asking questions about, what's the history of this? Is it true? And for whatever reason, I sort of became the regimental historian, so to speak. And I would answer those questions, and over 2, 4, 6 years, I just built up all this stuff, this evidence, these documents. I'd done all this research, and I thought, I need to write this down. Because if I get hit by a car, all this will be lost and forgotten again, and somebody will have to learn all this again from scratch. So that was really the genesis of the book. It's been a lot of weekend, and it took about 10 years for that reason.
Wow.
Of just piecing all this together in a narrative way. But it was fun. It was, again, I don't play golf, so this was my hobby.
Well, talk about what the professional historian's attitude is about this Mecklenburg
right.
Declaration of Independence of May 20th, 1775.
It's. I think if you ask 100 historians, first 95 of them would say never heard of it and who cares.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But of the five remaining, the six remaining, in most historically, it has been regarded as unproven or a hoax or forgotten. So there's been a big split in the historical community, but I think it's fair to say if you're in Chapel Hill or if you're at the universities, you're at your normal, collegiate historian or academic historian will say, we don't believe it, it's not true. And that's fine. That's part of the book we embrace. That's part of the book we deal with. That's life. I would say that attitude has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. In the last chapter of my book, I talk about the views of, for example, David McCullough, who's a leading American historian. He says, I believe the story is true. Andrew Roberts, who's a leading British military historian, he's looked at the evidence. He thinks it's true. Cokie Roberts was here when we unveiled a statue several years ago, and she said it's absolutely true. So we're seeing a pendulum shift back towards at least a sort of neutral view of it. That it's not considered preposterous, which I think has been the common view in the past. But that's shifting a little bit. So that's good.
In the introduction to your book, you point out that your effort has been to be fair to all sides of the argument and present
right.
all sides of the argument as best you can, and then confess appropriately that you've come to believe that it really is true.
Right.
And I believe you're the only person I've talked to who has actually done, who's done the investigation,
right?
And has come to a conclusion. I'm a real big fan of Dan Morrill.
Yeah.
And Dan, you know, shocked us all 20 years ago when he said, "Well, I don't believe it." And you know, he was the historian of Charlotte, but yep. I said, "Dan, have you really done the background work on it?" And he said, "I've done enough to come to a conclusion."
Right.
In your book, you've gotten Dan to back off a little bit.
Right, right. Well, you know, and Dan, I can't speak for Dan, but Dan is a local historian, very well respected. I quote him in the book several times. And I think Dan's view is really kind of my view at this point. He said, you know, and to summarize Dan's point, he says, look, there's a lot of evidence out there. So the story cannot be proven or unproven. It is a matter of belief. And it really, you know, the primary evidence is the witnesses. You have 13 witnesses who testified towards a state congressional committee that they were there, that they saw the Mecklenburg Declaration have happened, that they were witnesses, you know, and they're all very credible witnesses. They were Revolutionary War veterans. They were Presbyterian ministers. One was the governor of North Carolina. So you have this—you have these witnesses who are all very credible, and if you believe their story, you believe their story. Now, the counter argument to that, and the skeptics will point out, they'll say, "Yeah, they're all credible witnesses. We agree they're not lying, but they all told the story 30 years after the fact, and at this point, they're all very old. So we, you know, our explanation of this is they are misremembering something that did happen, which is something called the Mecklenburg Resolve." Which we can talk about in a little bit if you want, which was sort of conditional, anti-British resolution that has been found that is not controversial. We know it exists. But so the skeptic's argument is, look, it's a case of mistaken identity. Everybody sort of remembers this 30 years later, and they're sort of making it more than it really was, when all that really happened was the Mecklenburg Resolve. It wasn't really a declaration of independence from England. No one would do that. So that explains why you have these witnesses, and that explains all the evidence.
To tell us, a good point to sort of get the story out there is to summarize the story that the witness, that these a number of witnesses told what happened, and what, according to them, what
right.
happened.
So here's the dummy's guide to MECDEC, so to speak.
Yeah.
MECDEC 101. Charlotte at this time, Mecklenburg County in this area of North Carolina, is populated by Scotch-Irish settlers who are very devout Presbyterians and very anti-English. And they are living here, you know, at the end of an Indian trading path in the woods. And in the spring and summer of 1775, tensions are rising in the British and the American colonies. A lot of people think war is about to break out with Britain, which it will. And you have all these local militia leaders who are meeting in a log courthouse in downtown Charlotte.
You're just going to have to forgive me because I'm so interested in the story. I'm going to break all the rules of interviewing. These guys got word somehow of the great killing at Lexington and Concord,
right.
And they got angry.
That's exactly what happened. They're meeting anyway, and then a rider arrives in Charlotte, an express rider on horseback, who brings them news of the battles of Lexington and Concord that had occurred exactly 1 month earlier, on April 19th, 1775. And they are outraged. One of the witnesses writes later that, you know, we smelt and felt the blood and carnage of Lexington, which raised all the passions into fury and revenge, close quote. And so for 24 hours, they debate in the courthouse, what do we do about this? And according to legend, they draft something called the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, which says, we are now free and independent of Great Britain. And then they tasked the local tavern owner named James Jack to ride to Philadelphia and to give this to Congress. Congress at the time is debating something called the Olive Branch Petition, which is basically a measure of reconciliation with Great Britain. So they were not interested in, let's start a whole civil war here. So they send Jack home with a letter of thanks and say, thank you, but no thank you, we're not ready for this. And that's the story. I mean, that's the story that the witnesses recount in a nutshell. And that story probably would have remained probably would have been forgotten, frankly, but would have it been best a sort of historical curiosity, you know, a piece of local history that, you know, no one really cares too much about. But
how
then,
it was not discussed openly or publicized
right.
for a long period of time. No celebrations, no
That's right.
Writing. What brought it to light, and when did it come to light to the public, and how did that happen?
So the first, one of the descendants of one of the principal guys that was involved in the MECDEC, in the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, living here in Charlotte, named Dr. Joseph Alexander, finds in his deceased father's papers an account of this Mecklenburg Declaration. And, you know, and it was sort of locally known here in Charlotte. People knew about it. But all, by this point, this is 1819. You know, this is 35 years later. Or 45 years later, all the major characters are dead. You know, the papers have been lost in the fire, the original papers. But he publishes this paper, giving an account of the Mecklenburg Declaration, the same story I just told you. But he publishes it in the Raleigh Register. And the Raleigh Register circulates this, and it sets off a firestorm. Sets off a national debate. And the reason it does is because this paper finds its way to John Adams.
And here's where I want to take a break, because
sure.
we're going to learn from you how Thomas Jefferson and John Adams viewed this report about the 40-year-old Mecklenburg Declaration. I'm talking to Scott Slaker. We're talking about his brand-new book about the Mecklenburg Declaration, called The First American Declaration of Independence. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Charlotte attorney Scott Seifert, who is also the author of a new book about one of my favorite topics, the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. The book is called The First American Declaration of Independence, The Disputed History of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775. And Scott, before the break, you'd mentioned that the matter was sort of dormant, as best we can tell, not much talked about, not written about, not really known about until a report was published and came to the attention of former President John Adams. And what did he think about this?
Well, so that's exactly right. So President Adams is living in retirement in Quincy, Massachusetts. And he sees a copy of this Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence published in the local paper, the Essex Register. And John Adams has a fascinating reaction to this story. He immediately writes a letter to Thomas Jefferson. And now, you have to understand where the story goes. You have to understand the relationship between Adams and Jefferson. At this point in their life, they're basically, at best you could say, frenemies, in that they had been political adversaries at one time. They later hated one another. And at this point, there'd been somewhat of a reconciliation, but the reality is Adams couldn't stand Jefferson, thought he was a fraud. And
still, even in the midst of this warm correspondence that
yeah.
we celebrate so much in America,
yeah,
you
exactly.
say he was just pretending.
Yeah, and it doesn't. This part of the story doesn't really reflect that well on Adams. But so Adams writes a letter to Jefferson in which he says about the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. He says, quote, "The genuine sense of America at that time has never been so well expressed before, nor since," close quote. But the letter is very passive-aggressive and snide, and he mentions several places that Jefferson must have seen this, that Jefferson must have known about it, which implies that Jefferson had seen the Mecklenburg Declaration and hushed it up. And we know this interpretation is true because privately, at the same time, Adams writes to several colleagues of his, and he says, "Mr. Jefferson must have seen this in the time of it because he has copied the expressions, the sense of it, verbatim." He literally accuses Jefferson of plagiarizing the Declaration of Independence from the MECDEC.
One of the things that we didn't talk about is that the contents of the published copy of the Mecklenburg Declaration, there hasn't been so far an original copy of the Mecklenburg Declaration that's turned up. So
That's correct.
It was a reconstructed copy of the Mecklenburg Declaration. And if you believed that these, some people would argue that if you believe that the wonderful language that in some cases parallels the July 4th Declaration of Independence, that these had to come from the same source, you know.
Right.
So Adams is sort of accusing his friend Thomas Jefferson maybe of picking up the language from the Mecklenburg Declaration.
That's right.
Those other scholars would say this is obviously a copy of the so-called Mecklenburg Declaration has just picked up language from
right.
the real Declaration and put it in maybe some kind of document that might have been adopted. So it was, Adams is really stretching, isn't he, to call Jefferson. He was there when Jefferson was drafting this thing.
Well, see, and that's the ironic part of this story, because if you think about this, who knows Thomas Jefferson better than John Adams? And John Adams' instinctive response to seeing this is that Jefferson stole it, that Jefferson's a fraud and Jefferson's a plagiarist.
You don't think he was just teasing Jefferson?
He was not teasing Jefferson, because he's writing privately to others saying, I would as soon believe, you know, that the flowers in front of my eyes are a figment of my imagination as that this was not copied from the Declaration of Independence, or vice versa. So Adams really is the villain in the piece, because he sets this whole controversy. He does two things. One, he makes it a national controversy, which is great for the story, and the reason we're still talking about it, frankly, is because you've got Adams and Jefferson debating it. But the battle lines are set, and every discussion about this subject becomes one of, for the next 200 years, becomes, you either think, you're either with Jefferson that the whole thing's a fraud and a hoax, or you're with Adams, and if you're with Adams, you have to address the argument that did Jefferson plagiarize this, or vice versa. You know, is this whole thing a hoax that was sort of roughly drafted by somebody, you know, 50 years later while they were looking at the Declaration of Independence?
Here's what your story really, one of the things that got me excited was the understanding that all of a sudden, after being dormant for many years, 40 years or so, this becomes a matter of national argument.
Right.
It, and then the people in Mecklenburg who hadn't been talking too much about it are required to come forward and either take a side one way or another, say
right.
it happened or it didn't. And they said, yeah, it happened.
That's right. And what I find, you know, what I find fascinating about the story, you know, you can get into the back and forth and the arguments and the counter-arguments, but the fact that this really becomes the Da Vinci Code, this becomes the big historical controversy of the 19th century. You've got American presidents involved. You've got President James K. Polk, right, who's one of his grandnephew is one of the major actors in this drama, who sends historians to London to go look for papers. You have articles written and counter-arguments written. It becomes the biggest event in North Carolina. You know, they put the date on the state flag as a testimony that, you know, we don't care what the doubters say. We believe the story. So it becomes, you know, this national controversy. And then it just, over 150 years, it fizzles and runs out of steam for a variety of reasons.
Well, it was, as a live argument, if you're a patriotic North Carolinian, mm-hmm. you got to stand up for your colleagues. And the other thing you also mentioned in your book, that this became sort of a matter of the North Carolinians in the history of the Revolutionary War had been sort of frozen out. The people who wrote the histories didn't give us, that is North Carolinians, credit for having a big part in it, and South Carolinians and the Virginians, and then of course the New Englanders were trying
right.
to take
That's
all the
right.
credit. So it, politicians jumped in. You had to be in favor of this, I guess.
That's right. That's right. It becomes the Adams-Jefferson letters turn this into a political controversy that, you know, if you're from Virginia or you're from Massachusetts, you have to oppose this story because it gives primacy to North Carolina in the American Revolution.
Scott, did these letters, I thought these letters were private. Were they published out and put out there for us, for the public to take sides between Jefferson and Adams early on?
No, you're exactly right. They were private letters between Adams and Jefferson that were not published until 2 years later.
Okay.
So there was a period of time where no one had seen the letters, and then all of a sudden they're published, and then you know, everything explodes.
That's what reignites it,
that's
the
right.
publication
that's
of these
exactly.
letters.
That's exactly right. The letters are published in, I believe it's Thomas Jefferson's collected letters after his death, and then that's when everything goes haywire, and everyone's sort of writing arguments or, you know, letters or papers back and forth, defending or attacking the story, depending on which side you're on.
I have to take a break, and then
sure.
I want to come back and have you tell us about the commission that developed in North Carolina about this time to settle the matter.
Yep.
And we're talking about, of course, the Mecklenburg Declaration, and it's all in the context of a new book written by our guest, Scott Seifert, called The First American Declaration of Independence? He and I'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Scott Seifert, who is the author of a new, is the Charlotte attorney, the author of a new book called The First American Declaration of Independence, question mark, The Disputed History of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775. Scott, before the break, we were talking about the argument or the exchange of views between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson about an event that happened in Mecklenburg County 40 or more years before we were arguing about it. And it became, as you explained to us, and then explained in great detail in your book, it became a matter in which North Carolinians felt the need to sort of prove that this event, we hadn't talked about it in a long time, but now that it's out there, it happened. And the governor got involved.
Right, right.
What happened?
So, you know, politicians, like, as you know, DJ, we love to get involved in things. And this is a matter of state pride. So what happens after the Jefferson and Adams letters are published and read, and Jefferson comes out as a very, you know, comes out as a disbeliever in the story. And his famous words are, to Adams, are, "You seem to think it genuine. I believe it's spurious." So Jefferson, and that's the quote, spurious, that's always associated with the story. Jefferson says, "I've never heard of this. No historians that I know have heard of this. Never been discussed. I don't believe it." So people in North Carolina are quite bent out of shape about this. Jefferson also sort of gratuitously insults some of the local North Carolina
people. Oh, tell us about that. Yeah, this was right. This is a horrible part that I had not known before.
So this part of what kicks off the anti, you know, the states' rights issue is that when Jefferson writes back to Adams discussing that deck, you know, he points out that he had never heard about it from North Carolina's delegates to the Second Continental Congress in the summer of 1775. Those were Richard Caswell, who's one of the first governors of, you know, free North Carolina, William Hooper, and Joseph Hughes. And he goes in great detail about all three, and he mentions in particular of William Hooper. He says to Adams, "You remember as well as I do, there was no greater Tory in Congress than William Hooper." Right?
Yeah, can you say that he signed the Declaration of Independence?
Right. So not a great compliment to William Hooper. And he says similarly disparaging remarks about Caswell and Hughes. And this irritates everyone in North Carolina. And, you know, you have books published. There's a great local kind of, I don't know, civic advocate guy named Joseph or Sewell Jones, who writes a book entitled, you know, A Defense of North Carolina Against the Aspersions of Mr. Jefferson. So people are publishing books like that, and everyone wants to get involved. So finally, the governor, Montfort Stokes at the time, says, "Look, right, okay, we're going to settle this controversy once and for all." So he convenes an independent commission of, you know, some of the descendants of some of the major participants in the story, like William Polk, who was actually the mayor of Raleigh at the time, and a very, very famous Revolutionary War hero, and some Alexanders and some of the local guys, and they say, "Right, we're going to prove this. How do we do this?" So they write to all the surviving folks in Mecklenburg County around Charlotte, and, you know, most of these guys are dead, but they do find James Jack, who's the tavern owner. He writes a letter. He's living in Georgia, but he writes a letter saying, "Yes, this is true. I delivered the Mecklenburg Declaration." John Davidson, who's now 95 years old, writes a letter. Humphrey Hunter. So there's four or five, you know, guys in the area who write very detailed testimony. Some of it's four, five, six pages long about their remembrances about MECDEC. And they publish this. The governor writes an introduction to it, and they say, "Here's the governor's report. This is the end of the discussion, right? We've got all these witnesses. This should prove this beyond anybody's reasonable doubt." And of course, it doesn't.
Why not? With all of this, with well, reliable people who were there.
Right.
The only argument would be they're old, they're senile, or it's so long ago. How could you expect somebody to remember that long ago?
That's right. Well, that really is the argument. The argument is, you know, there's sort of two arguments. The first is the whole thing's a hoax. Well, that argument gets blown apart pretty effectively when you have a bunch of credible witnesses saying, "No, we believe it," including people like William Polk, the mayor of Raleigh, and others who you can't easily discount. But the argument was, look, 30, 40 years later, these guys are very old. You know, we're not saying they're lying, but we're saying that what they remember is somehow, you know, they're inflating it, you know, in their retelling. They're inflating it in their own mind.
So it's you don't jump on it as a hoax with these fine people. You say it's been a long time.
It's been a long time. We're not sure they was. And really, the major issue for the skeptics is, okay, let's say we believe all the witnesses. Show us the document.
Yeah.
And there is no document because the papers are all lost.
Well, but it's been published, or a version of it has been published.
That's correct.
There's now you know, my big reserve, I mean, the question I've got is really Jefferson's. I haven't heard of this, you know, at this point in time. If this were really, if this has really happened, these people would have been talking about it. They would have been, having celebrations and writing people about it. It would have been a matter of public knowledge. And how do you get over that? How did the governor's commission, and then how do you get over that? Almost unbelievable absence of discussion about it during
there's not an absence of discussion so much. I mean, there is evidence that people did discuss it, and the most famous of which is the British governor of the time, Josiah Martin, the last British governor of North Carolina. And he writes a letter in June of 1775 to his superiors in London, the Earl of Dartmouth, in which he says, you know, the resolves of the Committee of Mecklenburg, which you'll see in this newspaper, which I'm mailing you, quote, surpass all the horrid and treasonable publications that the inflammatory spirits of this continent have yet produced, close quote. So the British were talking about it. I mean, the British governor said, Mecklenburg County is in full rebellion, and they passed these resolutions, and we need to deal with them. So you have that going on. You have the Moravians who are writing to their colleagues. We've got the Moravian journals that are written in German, but they say things like, Mecklenburg County has unseated all its magistrates and, you know, has declared itself free and independent from Great Britain. We don't know what to do about this.
You put this, all these things, some of them were brand new to me and wonderful to know, but those are the very contemporary reports of what these folks understood happened in Mecklenburg County. But during and then after the war, after the Revolutionary War, until this 30 or 40 years later event, there appears to be no real civic embracement of this Mecklenburg Declaration as burst out when the controversy based on the publication in the Raleigh newspaper of a version of the Mecklenburg. I mean, so how do you explain that? Or how can we explain that?
Well, I mean, one way to look at it is, let's remember the area we're talking about. So in 1805, let's say, you know, in Mecklenburg County, there are, 300 people living here? You know, the British had occupied the area twice during the Revolutionary War. They burned all the buildings down. In fact, most of the major characters in the story, James Jack, Thomas Polk, and others, had left town. They'd moved to Tennessee or Georgia. And the area was really quite devastated. Not a lot of people were here. So I'm not sure there's an absence of, you know, what were they thinking to write about. There's no printing press in Charlotte. You know, there's no major industry. I mean, this really was the backcountry. So
You got the Hopewell Church, you've got the Davidsons, you've got the Alexanders, you've got these people, and you do have a sense of that group of people have always been appropriately proud of their heritage and their ancestors.
Absolutely correct. But bear in mind, it did live on as a local legend, for example. I mean, it did live on in the local lore. You know, some of the gravestones of some of the participants have things written on them that say things like, you know, Humphrey Hunter, for example, is a Presbyterian minister, and his grave in Charlotte says he was a leading participant in the revolutionary movement of May 20th, 1775.
These were people who were buried after, weren't they? After the explosion of the controversy.
Some were and some were not. For example, there's a poem dated 1803 that a school child, you know, memorized Still Creek that talks about the events of May. There is a, there's a guy named Benjamin Wilson Davidson who was born on May 20th, and he was known sort of around town as Independence Ben. But your bigger point, which is right, I mean, this is the whole controversy in a nutshell, is you can't prove it. You don't have a document. You have these pieces of evidence which are very interesting. You get the Moravians. But yeah, it is, if you want to look at it from a perspective of, you know, that's all quaint and interesting, but to me it doesn't prove the story. That's a reasonable perspective to have, for sure. And that's probably the mainstream perspective historically.
Well, let's take a quick break. Time's moving too fast, and there's some more things I want you to talk about, interesting things about the history of Mecklenburg County after we came to accept that the Declaration was real and proved that it was real. I'm visiting with Scott Seifert, who's the author, a Charlotte attorney, author of a brand new book, the first American Declaration of Independence, ? He and I'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about something that comes to my mind every spring, and that is the May 20th Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. And there's a brand new book written about it, if you joined us late, written by Scott Seifert. It's called The First American Declaration of Independence. And then it's got a question mark in the title. Scott, so much more to talk about in terms of the wonderful intersection of American history with this controversy.
Right.
One of the things in terms of local history is that the Mecklenburg County and the Charlotte community and, to a large extent, the state of North Carolina embraced this story, whether it was true or not, right, of the Mecklenburg Declaration, and it became an occasion for celebration and a lot of bragging rights. Tell us what happened when the state accepted the idea that we really had been the first to declare our independence.
And it really, you know, it's interesting about this story. There's so many levels to it, but part of what interests me so much in it, among other things, is the fact this was the biggest thing in North Carolina for 150 years, especially because it's now such a forgotten, you know, unknown, or largely unknown historical event. But yes, that's right. I mean, this became the thing North Carolina was known for in 1875, on the 100th anniversary of the MEC Dec. You know, the front page of the International Herald Tribune covered the big celebration in Charlotte. You had 150,000 people in Charlotte, which is a city of 6,000 people then. It was a week-long holiday. We had four sitting American presidents come to Charlotte to celebrate MEC Dec Day. We had Taft in 1904. We had President Wilson in 16. And the most recent was Gerald Ford in 1975. When North Carolina was asked to give a stone to the Washington Monument, you know, if you go inside the Washington Monument, there's 50 stones that celebrate all the various states. And they each have one thing on it. The stone that North Carolina chose to give says, "First in Freedom, the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, May 20th, 1775. And as you point, you know, as we started with, you know, it's the date on the state flag and the state seal. So it has all these connotations that, you know, have been forgotten but were embraced for so long. And it also had some negative connotations. When North Carolina seceded from the Union at the beginning of the Civil War, it did so on May 20th, 1861. And that date was not coincidental. You know, Confederate battle flags from our region would have the two dates side by side on them because, you know, they saw themselves as, this was a continuation of what our ancestors did in 1775 against the British. We're doing against the federal government in North Carolina. So you have all these layers of it. And to take that a step further, when we had civil rights, you know, marches and protests in Charlotte, in the 1960s, they were conducted on May 20th. So It has all these levels of, because that was the civic holiday. You know, we didn't celebrate Memorial Day and didn't celebrate the 4th of July for a long period of time.
Well, so, what you guys are reviving this, earlier on you mentioned kind of gave me the feeling that DG, since you left Charlotte,
yeah,
we've been able to get this
thing
going.
Things have really improved since you left Charlotte, DG. No, you know, the Charlotte community has really taken to this story in the last 10 years, and I think it's because people are looking for things that are authentic with our city, which is, you know, a big city with big buildings but it looks like it's 10 years old. So when people hear the story and you tell them the city's 250 years old and this happened here, they think, that's unbelievable. Sort of the same reaction I had 10 years ago. So we've seen a huge resurgence in interest in the story. You know, there is a $600,000 bronze statue of Captain James Jack in front of Central Piedmont Community College near uptown. We have something called the Charlotte Liberty Walk, which you can walk in downtown Charlotte and see all these, you know, where the old buildings used to be, the cemeteries, the things of that nature. And so we've seen a real resurgence of interest in this. And what we've tried to stay away from, honestly, is getting out of the historical controversy business. Now, saying, look, we recognize this is controversial. We recognize there's a segment of the academic community, for sure, or even, you know, people in general who say, I don't believe the story. That's not an unreasonable position to have.
Sort of like Moses in the Red Sea.
That's right.
In Sunday school, would you really believe it happened exactly
that way?
But let's celebrate it because it's so important in terms of our culture and
history.
It's
so important in terms of North Carolina history, and it's just a cool story. You know, everybody can get behind fighting the British. There's no downside to that. So we stay out of in the book, the purpose of the book is not to say, you know, here's 400 pages to prove it's true. Or 400 pages to disprove it, but say, look, here's all the evidence.
Here's the wonderful argument that we can have together and
this
celebrate.
This is the argument. Look, we've been arguing about this for 240 years, so it'd be great if they argued about it for another 240 years, because that's what makes it interesting. If everybody knew it was true or vice versa, then who cares?
Well, you know, one of the downsides to the celebration of the Mecklenburg Declaration is that it puts aside something that apparently many people agree on, and that is that there were, on May 31st, adopted some very important resolves that show Mecklenburg resolves that were implementation of the idea of we're going to have to operate independently, assuming independence, but pretty treasonous activities.
Absolutely.
That we now sort of may underappreciate. One of the things that your book did that I didn't realize, that your book taught me that I had not realized before, was that the actual text of the Mecklenburg resolves, which people agree upon and no controversy about that, but that they weren't really discovered and made public until after this controversy developed.
That's right.
That's just brand new to me. Explain how that happened. I mean, everybody agrees that Mecklenburg, no controversy about that because we've got documentary evidence, but
that's
we
right.
didn't have that documentary evidence before us until after the Mecklenburg Declaration controversy developed.
When Adams and Jefferson correspond, their correspondence is published and this becomes a controversy, historians start looking for more evidence. And they don't actually find this piece of evidence that you're referring to until late 38. And a researcher
1838.
That's right, mm-hmm. 1838. So quite a bit later. So a researcher in Charleston finds in an old newspaper called the South Carolina Gazette and Country Journal, June 1775, finds in it, and it's still there, by the way. You can go and see it, touch it. Pretty cool. But in it, there's a series of resolves from Charlottetown, and they're dated May 31st, 1775. And they're clearly authentic, right? They're printed in the newspaper. So these become known as the Mecklenburg Resolve. Now, they have a different date than the MECDEC. You know, they're 11 days later, as you point out. They don't read anything like what the MECDEC was supposed to sound like. These are very long. They're 20 resolutions, and they say things like, DG, you're in charge of gunpowder. We're now in court on the third Tuesday of every month. If you spit in the street, you're going to be fined 4 shillings.
Yeah, it wasn't bureaucratic. Like that. There was some pretty important stuff.
Well, I'm being a little glib, but yeah. but they start off saying, now that we're, you know, more or less, now that we're independent of Great Britain, here's the rules of the county. So these Mecklenburg resolves have an interesting effect on the controversy because they don't change anybody's mind, right? So if you believe the story of the MECDEC, you say, well, this is entirely consistent with the story. They declare independence, and 11 days later, they adopt these, whatever these are, and these are sort of bylaws or administrative code of the county, but it's all consistent with the story. Mm. If you are a skeptic, however, this is the hammer that you need to beat up the story because the argument then becomes, this is all they passed. This is the quote-unquote, you know, in quote, the Mecklenburg Declaration. But it doesn't say we are free and independent. It doesn't say that we declare independence from Great Britain. It's a much less grandiose document.
It happened, but it didn't.
People are selling them.
It happened, but it didn't happen the way these old-timers say they remember.
That's exactly. You're overselling the story. And so that's the argument to this day, by the way. That is where the battle lines still remain. They are, you know, the skeptics will say, we believe in the resolves, the Mecklenburg resolves. They're clearly true. I mean, that's not in dispute. But that's really all that happened. And they're interesting, as you point out. But, you know what, a lot of different counties had similar stuff like this. So it's not that great. So that's the skeptics' argument. And the counter-argument is, these are proof of the overall story. They're not the MECDEC. They're something different, but they corroborate the general spirit of the story.
Well, we just got a minute. And one of the great things about this story is your story of having an emotional attachment to the MECDEC, then doing all this research and compiling it and then having to look at it and coming to to your own personal conclusion, at least at the time of writing the book, that this really happened. And this is kind of like a religious argument. Do you not have periods of doubt, and how do you deal with them when you
I don't have any. You know, it's funny, and I'll try to be brief on that, we're wrapping up, but when I started the book, I was absolutely convinced. Halfway through the book, I actually talked myself out of it, and I was convinced they were not true, because I read all the skeptics. And then by the end of the book, I'd come full circle, and I now believe the story again. But look, I recognize, I mean, there's a lot of good arguments, like a lot of theories of why it isn't true. But no, on balance, you know, the evidence is what it is.
Thanks for sharing this great story with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed talking to you.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.